Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, I have three great guests for you today. Coming up around 12:30, she's a wife, mother, and award-winning producer of the sleeper hit What the Bleep Do We Know. Betsy Chassey says she thought she had it all figured out until she realized she didn't. And we're going to be talking to her about her new book, Tipping Sacred Cows. We'll also be talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author Charles Duhigg. Charles has been on the show before about his book, The Power of Habit. It's just come out in paperback. It is a New York Times bestseller. And he's going to be talking to us today about setting up cues. So if you have a problem changing a habit, or if those New Year's resolutions are starting to slip, or maybe never even got off the ground, then stay tuned, because Charles has some science-based habit formation tips for us. First, I'm very pleased to welcome Canadian writer and author Brian Peyton. He's written for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the Boston Globe. He's the author of The Shadow of the Bear, Travels in Vanishing Wilderness, which was chosen as a Barnes & Noble Book Club pick, a Pearls pick on NPR, and a 2006 National Outdoor Book Awards Book of the Year. The Ice Passage, a true story of ambition, disaster, and endurance in the Arctic wilderness. And he's also written a novel, Hail Mary Corner. They were all published to acclaim in Canada. He does live up in Vancouver, and his new book is called The Wind Is Not a River. Brian Peyton, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Wanted to start out with this, because this is the story that you have. You decided to tell as fiction, but it was sparked by facts that are little known in the lower 48 states of America. So let's begin with that, and then we'll see how that translated
sure.
into a book here. So you grew up for some time, I think, in Alaska as a kid.
I actually lived there for 3 years only, but I was sort of I was my teens. I was 13 to 16. Those years were spent up there, and I came from the lower 48 states, and as a precocious young man who thought he, well, knew it all, of course, but thought I also had a good grasp on the history of American involvement in World War II. Well, of course, I was wrong, as are so many other North Americans. There was a large military buildup in Alaska, and in fact, the Japanese seized and held two of the outermost islands of the Aleutian chain. And there was a 10-month aerial campaign to dislodge them from the Aleutian Islands, and a very pitched battle to finally get them out. And in terms of the numbers of men engaged, the battle to retake Attu is the most costly American battle in the Pacific theater after Iwo Jima. So when I learned all those facts, I thought, oh my God, I can't believe that people don't know this. And then in my late teens and early 20s, I started reading the available nonfiction histories of the war there. And there's some fantastic nonfiction that's been done, but people don't know to reach for it because it's
right.
not in the popular culture.
Right.
And then when I thought about why is that, that led me to the fact that the U.S. government had a very strict censorship campaign on the media at the time. And I learned that, in fact, there were U.S. journalists who were going up to Alaska, and they were rounded up and sent home by the U.S. government, and that, in reality, two of those journalists snuck back into Alaska to try to cover what was happening there, because so many of the other battles throughout World War II had the benefit of media involvement. Well, the government caught them, sent them home, and said, look, if you do this again, you could be imprisoned under the Sedition Act. And so those journalists went on to cover other battles. I realized then and there I had my story, and that would be what would happen if one of those journalists actually succeeded and got to be behind enemy lines in Alaska and find out what was happening there with the troops. And so that was my fictional creation. John Easley is a journalist, and he finds himself driven to report on the war in Alaska, but things go terribly wrong, really on the first page. He finds himself stranded behind enemy lines.
But boy, does it draw you in.
Well, thank you. And you know, he is. He's there on the land, and he finds himself not cast into the role that he hoped to do, which was to be there to quickly report back home what's happening, but he becomes part of the story, and he is locked in a survival episode for himself. And then, of course, at home, he's left someone at home, and he's left his wife home in Seattle, and they had parted under very unfortunate circumstances. She told him not to go to Alaska. His family had already given enough. His brother had been killed over in Europe, and he said, "No, this is my duty. No one knows about this. I'm one of the few journalists in the world who know where the Aleutian Islands are on the map. I have a duty to tell this story." And so they leave under unfortunate circumstances, and then he goes radio silent. She doesn't hear anything from him. So she sets out on a fairly epic quest to go find him, find out what happened to him, and she believes he's still alive, and to bring him home to start their lives again.
Yeah. Yeah. You say that you set out to write a war story, and in your mind's eye, you thought, okay, there's going to be a lot of battle scenes, a lot of men in battle. And very quickly, that didn't happen. You became more interested in the survival of one person, John Easley, and the war became something off stage. So you say you were left with this existential survival story.
Exactly. Yes. That's exactly how I felt. I felt, okay, there's going to be, you know, chapter after chapter, scene after scene of battle. And of course, readers won't be disappointed that does happen toward the end of the book. But nonfiction, because I write both fiction and nonfiction. Nonfiction, particularly when it comes to things like this, these large-scale events, and in the case of a battle, I would need, of course, to tell the story of people, and that would be the American troops, the Japanese troops, and of course the Aleuts, who were removed from the Aleutian Islands, some by the Japanese, the rest by the Americans. And I thought, no, that's already been done. I need to tell the story of one person or two people. And so instead of telling the story of a people, I'm telling the story of two persons. And so when I got that in my mind, I realized that I can tell a larger story through these fictional lives.
Yeah. And it is a love story. Each chapter is from the perspective of John, and then the next one is from the perspective of Helen, his wife. Why did you decide to do it that way?
It just naturally flowed for me. You know, John Easley, in the first chapter, comes alive, comes on quite strong, and his personality was very clear to me, and his motivations were very clear to me right away. And so as I was writing that first chapter and coming to the end of the first chapter, I thought, well, he's a mystery to me that I have to unravel as a writer, and I hope the reader is involved in unraveling that mystery. But I kept realizing that a large part of who he is points at someone else outside, another strong personality that is he's left behind. And so who is that person? And then in chapter two, Helen came into my mind, and I realized that, no, who is this woman who would be with this kind of guy? And so I became equally fascinated in who she was and what her motivations were and what she does with the hand she's dealt.
Yeah, a strong woman, strong woman. Let's look a bit about some of the research that you did, because you actually went to the Aleutian Islands.
Sure.
And this book, I understand, was 10 years in the making. So tell us a little bit about the research you put
sure.
into it and how it came together.
Sure. You know, to backtrack, that I had been interested in this since I was a young teenager, and so I sort of filed the story away in my mind as it would be a good one. And I moved from Anchorage down to British Columbia when I was 16. I've been here ever since in the Vancouver area. But I kept coming back to the story. Like, I've got to do something about it. And finally, that itch turned into the desire to, you know, look, I'm going to write the definitive dramatic history of this war. But before you can do that, you need to go there. And
yeah.
That's where my nonfiction,
yeah.
you know, my nonfiction habits as a writer kick in. I need to get out on the land. I need to see what the weather is like. I need to get my boots on the ground. I need to go out into the wilderness and experience what this place is like for myself, so I can get some insight into the native Aleut people who live there, and to really get some kind of inkling into what the American troops and the Japanese troops were facing. You know, the Aleutian Islands are, in a sense, both battlefield and enemy for both the Japanese and the American troops there. So many of the casualties that happened in the Aleutian Island campaign were a direct result of the weather and the environment. So I wanted to experience that myself in order to bring those visceral details home to the reader.
Mm.
So I went out there.
And the country, I mean, the landscape out there is absolutely brutal. No trees on any of those 120 islands except for a couple of little spots of stunted shrubbery, I understand.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's, it's a shocking landscape. I've traveled around the world for my nonfiction, and it's unlike any other place that I've been. It's completely devoid of trees, or was at the time. In fact, a funny side story is that the lonely U.S. troops on Adak, the island sort of halfway down the chain, the forward base of operation, were so lonely for their homeland, they brought some trees in and planted three or four,
right.
And they called it the Aleutian National Forest. And those trees are still there. They're only about 10 feet high, but it's a testament to their determination to, you know, get back to where they're from. So, yeah, it's a very unusual landscape that is dominated by the wind and the weather. And the wind is unlike anything else. It's the birth of it's a place where the Willawa is born, which is the signature gale of the Aleutians. And this is a wind that, you know, will knock you to the ground, bully you, and, you know, rip the moisture from your eyes. It's unlike anything I've experienced before.
Mm.
And so it's shaped the lives of the Aleut people who've been there for thousands of years, and it definitely shapes the fortunes of the U.S. and Japanese troops who find themselves in this situation. And, of course, it directly affects the destinies of John and Helen Easley.
Yeah, it is a very intriguing story and beautifully written. I know that you said that writing nonfiction for you is like playing a chess game. Writing fiction is like playing with an Ouija board. So you got to do the two of them together on this one. Well, I want to let listeners know you are coming out to Seattle, and you're going to be up here this week, in fact.
That's right, yeah.
So do you want to tell us where? Do you want me to?
Please, if you've got it in front of you.
I've got it right in front of me, so go ahead. I'll go ahead and do that.
Okay.
So Wednesday, January 29th, 7 o'clock, you can see Brian Payton at Elliott Bay. He's going to talk, read, Q&A, and he's going to do signings. And that's at Elliott Bay, 7 o'clock, Wednesday, the 29th. And then the following day, Thursday, January the 30th, he'll be at Third Place Books and the one in Bothell. So he'll be doing the same again there, talking, reading, Q&A, and signing. Brian Payton, a final quick word you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
Well, I hope to see you there. I so much look forward to meeting people who are interested in this little-known bit of history and love and sharing in the conversation and stories behind the story. So hope to see you there.
Well, thanks. I think you brought it all to light in The Wind is Not a River, and you can find out more about Brian at brianpayton.com. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back with the author of The Power of Habit. Wall Street Journal and Financial Times named it as one of the best books of the year. And my guest is Charles Duhigg. We'll be right back.
Way up north to Alaska. Way up north to Alaska. North to Alaska. Go north, the rush is on. North to Alaska. Go north, the rush is on.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you love dogs, tune in to The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, live every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. We'll talk about everything dog and interview authors, experts, and amazing organizations, both locally and nationally. And don't even get me started on the pet food industry. I'm Julie Forbes. Find us online at www.dogradioshow.com and also as a free podcast on iTunes. The Dog Show with Julie Forbes, an evolved perspective on life with dogs.
Next week on Conversations Live, Jennifer Loudon, a pioneer of the self-care revolution and author of The Life Organizer, A Woman's Guide to a Mindful Year. And New York Times bestselling novelist Carla Neggers returns with her new story, Ciderbrook. Please join us every Monday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and 98.9 HD Channel 3. See conversationslive.net for upcoming show details and podcasts.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Made fresh each day for you. Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m.
And welcome back, everybody. I'm pleased to welcome back Charles Duhigg to the show. He joined us last year when his book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, came out. Fascinating read, and really, truly one of my favorite books on the power of habit. In fact, I think it probably is my favorite. I haven't found anything that's come past it yet. So let me tell you a little bit about Charles. He has a very impressive resume. He is a Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's the winner of the National Academies of Sciences, National Journalism and George Polk Awards. He is a frequent contributor to This American Life, Dr. Oz, NPR and PBS's NewsHour and Frontline. And has spoken to audiences as varied as MIT, the SC Johnson Company, TED, and he is a graduate of Harvard Business School and Yale College. And one more thing, I just learned, Eric said, he was on the Colbert Report this week. Charles Duhigg, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, I'm going to have to catch that because I did not see that, but Eric says it was very funny. So today, last time you joined us, we talked a lot about the book in general and about creating keystone habits, which can lead to multiple changes throughout our life. And today we're going to focus more on setting up the three-loop response. So this is based on neuroscience. So tell us a little bit about your three-step loop, if you would.
Sure. And this is the big, we're sort of living through this golden age of understanding the neurology of habit formation. And the big insight is that every habit, and habits are about 40 to 45% of what we do every day, that every habit has these three components. There's a cue, which is like a trigger for an automatic behavior to start. And then a routine, which is the behavior itself. And then finally, a reward. And what we've really learned is that it's these cues and rewards that influence these patterns in our lives far more than we even previously understood. And that if you want to change a habit or create a new habit, understanding what's triggering it and what reward is driving it really gets to the heart of how change is possible.
Mm. So when we first touched base on this, I heard that if we eat chocolate, it can help us maybe to improve
right.
our workout. So let's talk about how that works into that.
This was a really interesting experiment that was done where it was a healthcare plan in Germany, and they took a whole bunch of people and they said, look, everyone should exercise more. And all the people, well, they were Germans, so they said, everyone should exercise more. And everyone said, okay. And then they took a smaller group, a subset of them, and they said, this is what we want you to do. Before you go and you go for a jog, come up with some cue, like put your running shoes next to your bed or always meet your friends at the gym on Wednesday and work out with them. And then when you're done exercising, give yourself a small piece of chocolate. Because what they suspected is that even though people think that they want to start exercising, their brain essentially thinks that they're a liar and they hate exercise. That's why they haven't been doing it. And so to trick your brain into developing this habit, you have to give yourself a reward that you genuinely enjoy. And that will encourage this kind of neurological pathway that associates that activity and that cue with a specific reward. And 6 months later, they went and they tracked down everyone. And it turns out the people who had started giving themselves these small pieces of chocolate, not only were they exercising about 50% more than everyone else, they'd also stopped eating the chocolate.
Right.
Because their brains had learned that when you exercise, you have these neurotransmitters that make you feel good.
Right. Well, you only have to look at dogs. Every time I go to a coffee shop, my dog knows which ones are going to give him a treat and which ones are not. And drool is the giveaway there.
Absolutely. But there's this interesting and important distinction, right? Because we've known this since Pavlov, right?
Yeah,
that you can
yeah.
make dogs kind of anticipate food. The difference is that all of the studies show that when humans decide that something should be rewarding, it actually becomes rewarding. Right. A great example of this is, like, think of the first time you got, like, an A on your report card.
Mm-hmm.
It probably didn't mean that much because getting good grades doesn't mean anything until you decide that it means something positive, at which point you start developing pride and esteem and maybe your parents praise you. Deciding that something should be a reward makes it neurologically into an actual reward. And that's important because that suggests how we should think about our own habits. By giving ourselves rewards and deciding to let ourselves enjoy those rewards, it reinforces the neurology behind that behavior.
Right. And that's a good point, because we're not all going to be happy about the same reward. We're not going to get as motivated by the same reward. And you say very clearly in the book, you're not giving a one-size-fits-all prescription. This is basically a framework and a guideline that we can pull from.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the key here is that when you're in the grip of a habit, your brain kind of shuts off a little bit, right? That's why it feels so easy and like such an obvious thing to do. And in order to change that behavior or create a new one, you really have to drag it out of that part of your brain into the prefrontal cortex where you're making decisions. And once you do that, habits tend to be kind of delicate and easy to fiddle with.
Mm-hmm. And there's one habit you talk about, it's a simple habit like balancing your checkbook, because I hate doing that. I just make sure there's enough money in there where I don't have to do it. But, you know, if I were to sit down maybe, as you suggest, with a glass of wine on a Friday night and do it, maybe I'd have a better appreciation of doing it.
Absolutely. And the key is that when you do it, let yourself really enjoy that glass of wine. I think we all have this instinct that when we do something we're supposed to do, even if we give ourselves a reward, we try and like downplay the fun of the reward, right? Mm. I should be checking my checking account, and so. But what we know about our neurology is that our brain looks to how much we let ourselves enjoy rewards to figure out which of them are valuable.
Right.
So it's important when you sit down with that glass of wine, really luxuriate in the glass of wine, right?
Right.
Let
right.
yourself savor it. Make that reward actually rewarding.
Right. I want to talk to you about how long it takes to make a habit, because the popular self-help theory is it takes 21 days. But I've been reading The One Thing by Gary Keller, which is a number one Wall Street Journal bestseller. And he cited latest studies where he said that's absolutely not true. The popular theory is it takes 21 days, but it actually, the average number that it takes is 66 days. What do you have to say about that?
Well, it depends hugely based on like what habit you're talking about, what behavior and what person, right? If I wanted to start a habit involving like ice cream, I could probably do it in 5 minutes, but exercise might take a little bit longer. So there's really no formula for exactly how long it's going to take. But what we do know is this. We know, first of all, that any habit can be changed. It doesn't matter how old you are, how ingrained the behavior is, it can be changed. And equally, that because of how our neurology works, each time you do it, it's going to get a little bit easier. So day 3 is going to be easier than day 1, and day 21 is going to be easier than day 3. And at some point, your brain will essentially kind of make this behavior feel automatic.
Mm-hmm.
You won't even actually recognize that that's happened. In fact, that's one of the characteristics of habits, is that when it tips into this sort of automaticity, we tend to be unaware of that. It's only in retrospect that we can see that it's happened. But the point being is that if you diagnose a cue and a reward and you stick with it, chances are good that at some point, and usually quicker than you think, it's going to start feeling kind of effortless.
Right, right. I think this is a key thing as well. You say in the book, you say sometimes, as you said, change can take a long time. Sometimes it requires repeated experiments and failures. And that's where often I think we get in a mess because we just think, oh, well, you know, it's been 21 days and I can't do it.
Right.
And we just give up on
right.
it. But you say we do need to experiment. We need to shake it up and just experiment with our rewards.
Absolutely. And that failure part is actually kind of important. So there's a guy at University of Rhode Island named Jim Prochaska who's looked at how people quit smoking. And what he found is that most people who quit smoking have tried and failed 7 times previously on average. And that's kind of interesting, right, that people fail so frequently before they actually succeed.
Yeah.
But the reason why is because what he found happens is that the first 1 or 2 times someone relapses, they just kind of beat up on themselves. And then about time 3 or 4, they start all of a sudden learning from it, right? They say, oh, look, the reason I relapsed this time is I went over to my mother-in-law's and she drives me crazy and I got super stressed and so I had a cigarette. And it's that step where you begin learning about where your inflection points are, where you're likely to fail. When you begin learning from that failure, that's when all of a sudden you gain this appreciation of how to change your behavior in a way that's going to be permanent. So the key is not to look at a relapse or failure as an actual failure. It's this important learning experience that's integral to how change occurs. If you can change something just on your first time,
then it probably wasn't that tough a pattern in the first place. If you failed three or four times, that means you're actually on that path to making a permanent change in that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The key is to figure out, what can I just learn from this failure?
Right, right. Well, you've been on quite a journey with this book. You know, it's become a New York Times bestseller, and I know you've been speaking a lot about it. So what have you learned about yourself during this process? Because I think we can't go on that kind of journey without looking at ourselves a little more deeply.
You know, I the biggest one, as I mentioned before, is actually just how malleable every habit really is. You know, I have two kids, and my wife and I think about this all the time. I think that there's this feeling, and it's totally understandable, that if you've had a habit for 10 years or 15 years, that you just can't change it, right? It's too hard, or you're in your 50s and it's too hard to change. And yet what's interesting is every laboratory I've gone into has basically looked at that question, and they've disproven it. There are people who have been smoking for 2 decades who tomorrow will smoke their last cigarette. And there's people who are 65. There's literally tens of thousands of people who are 65 and were overweight their entire lives and will lose 25 pounds and keep it off for the rest of their life. The key is that when most people try and attack their habits, they don't pay attention to these cues and rewards. They don't really kind of do it in this methodical way that science tells us is the right way to do it. Or they become really disheartened because change seems hard. But once you know, and I'm not saying that like change, understanding the neurology of habits all of a sudden makes it incredibly easy, but it does make it easier. If you know how to start, and identifying these cues and rewards is where you should start, that first step is the hard one. And I'm just constantly amazed at how many people I talk to who say, I struggled with something for 2 decades, I figured out the cues and rewards, and it's been a year since I had a cigarette or I had a drink.
Right, right. So I'm going to get a little piece of chocolate and leave it by my running shoes then, as you suggest.
We'll see. Let me know how it goes.
We'll see if that works. I've actually been trying to train my dog to get in the habit of waking me up early for a run. That's another way of doing it. So a final thought that you'd like to leave our listeners with today?
Only that I would love to hear from folks who are who sort of have their own journeys. You know, my website is thepowerofhabit.com or charlesduhigg.com, and I actually respond to every email I receive, and my email address is on there. It's one of these things where like habits matter so much in ways that we don't think about it. It really doesn't matter like what you and I had for lunch today, right? But what we have for lunch every day matters enormously for our health and how we feel about ourselves. Any habit can be changed. It's just a matter of people sort of understanding how the habit works and diagnosing those cues and rewards. And if folks find something useful in the book, which is just out in paperback, I would love to hear from them and hear about how it impacted their life.
Okay. Well, great. Charles Duhigg, I thank you for joining us again and talking about the rewards, cues and rewards today. Charles's website is charlesduhigg.com, and there's a great flowchart on there that you can download to show you how you go through the habit process. Charles Duhigg, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And the book, again, is called The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. The best thing I've read on habits, so check it out. It's well worth checking out. And please do stay with us when we come back. We're joined by Betsy Chassie. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Every kiss, every hug seems to act just like a drug. You're getting to be a habit with me. Let me stay in your arms. I'm addicted to your charms. You're getting to be a habit with me.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Anti-Icky Poo, we cover the world of living successfully with your animal friends. This week, February 2nd, it's an abbreviated Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me. Due to sports, we'll be live from 9 to 10:30. So if you've been wanting to talk to me about your animal friends, plan to call in early. Open phone lines throughout on Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
More than 100 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. Works with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772. Conversations Live is giving away books, from New York Times best-selling fiction to the latest from innovative thought leaders in business and psychology. To find out where, when, and how, like us on Facebook at Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair and look out for posts titled Book Giveaway.
Clear, clean, and crisp. Check us out in digital quality sound on FM 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
But now I couldn't do without my supply. I need you for my own. Oh, I can't break away. I must have you every day, as regularly as coffee or tea.
And welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my next guest is Betsy Chassie. She's a filmmaker, author, speaker, and mother, best known as the co-creator behind the film What the Bleep Do We Know? Chassie is a featured blogger on internetblog.com and thedailylove.com, and she's been a featured columnist for multiple magazines and online sites, most recently Select Magazine and Common Ground. She's currently filming the follow-up to What the Bleep Do We Know, which is due out later this year. Betsy Chassie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And I want to let listeners know your new book is called Tipping Sacred Cows, the uplifting story of spilt milk and finding your own spiritual path in a hectic world. So let's begin with this. Publishers Weekly said, Chassie knocks herself off her own pedestal in this irreverent answer to the 2005 sleeper hit film she co-created, What the Bleep Do We Know? She seemed to have all the answers and has come to doubt the neat conclusions that once satisfied. Do you think that's a fair assessment of the book?
I think so. I mean, everybody likes to kind of relate it back to What the Bleep. It wasn't really a follow-up to What the Bleep. It's really just sort of my personal story. And yes, of course, you know, anything that happened in my life after the bleep was called a follow-up. So,
right. There's plenty in the book that's not pre What the Bleep.
No, there's a little bit of the stuff that's pre What the Bleep, but a lot of it, you know, a lot of it talks about, I mean, there's stuff that talks about my childhood. I mean, it's really a personal story and a personal exploration into what do some of these ideas that we hold to be sacred in the new age, new thought world, what do they really mean to us trying to live, you know, our lives?
Right. And hence the title, Tipping Sacred Cows, because you describe a sacred cow as something we hold up against criticism, and you're basically tipping it upside down here, right?
That's right. I mean, I tip over not only the sacred cows of new age or spirituality or self-help, but also my own personal sacred cows about myself.
So why did you want to write the book? Let's define that.
Gosh, it's great. I mean, everybody keeps asking me that question, like, why do I want to write the book? It's interesting because, I mean, that's what I do. I'm a creative person. I express my life through film, through writing, storytelling. And so for me, you know, part of writing this book, it was the first time I'd written something, well, kind of a second, because I had another book out a little while ago called Metanoia, which was much smaller, but it was the first time I did anything where I didn't have a character to hide behind. there was no, you know, narrative here that was sort of fictional. This is really my story and my words. And so it was, I felt like, you know, because part of what I was tipping over was this notion that, you know, we tend to live a lie. We tend to live our story. We tend to live the roles and the masks that we wear. And what I wanted to do was not do that. And so the only way that I could do that was to write my own story and not, you know, write a fictional character.
Well, that's a good enough reason to write the book. I want to talk about, just let's dive straight into the book. On page 63 here, you're talking about law of attraction and manifesting, and you say there was a point when you got cocky and you decided this manifesting thing, this law of attraction trick was easy, and I didn't have to work at it anymore. Talk to us a little bit about that time, if you would.
Sure. Well, you know, I think what happens is that we get sort of, excuse me, I have a froggy in my throat. We get really comfortable, you know, and we start to think, oh, I can do this because things start coming easily. And maybe things start coming easily because we're living the law of attraction or we're excellent manifestors. Or maybe we've just, you know, let our expectations down, or maybe we've just stopped dreaming. I don't know. But, you know, for me, I think what I got really good at was just living my bull, you know, living my bullshit. I don't know if I have a potty mouth. But, you know, I just got really good at living my story. And what I got really good at doing was ignoring that I was unhappy. And so it really wasn't that my life was manifesting the way I wanted it to. It was just coming together the way my story wanted it to. And what I, you know, it's always fascinating to me. I'm always laughing now at the fact that it takes, like, it always takes us humans some sort of big crisis to stop and go, whoa, wait a second, this isn't right. And that happened a couple times in my life. That happened right before I made The Bleep, and it happened right before I wrote this book. And the second thing that a big, you know, crisis that came to me was that, you know, I got divorced. And in doing that, I finally said to myself, you know, I really would like to try to not have a big crisis every 10 years that blows my life up. So how do I do that? And so in order to do that, I really had to sort of let go of the cool colloquialisms, you know, the pithy quotes on Facebook and, you know, the one-liners that sort of all sounded really cool, and actually do the work to get down to trying to find my true self, my true soul's desire, and finding that core piece of me that was happy so that I could really live the life that I wanted.
Right. And it's a very funny book. I mean, I laughed out loud in several places.
Thank you.
And you seem to have this spunky, I was looking at a couple of videos that you've done, you seem to have a very spunky personality, which is great. How has that played into getting you where you are today?
Well, I think I'm just really, you know, resilient. I was a child actress, and so I learned that, you know, smiling, being happy, and putting on a show makes everybody around you happy and makes everybody around you like you, and it's all very safe and easy. And it also, I think, you know, my father taught me from a very early age that, you know, you have to laugh. And so I think that was instilled in me from a very early age. So there's a part of me that sort of laughs at everything, and then there's a part of me that laughs because then you don't have to see me cry. At this point in my life, I've come to the place where I can keep that spunky, fun, lightheartedness, but I still want to experience the dark night of the soul, because through that, you know, that's where creativity lands. That's where the, you know, real stuff starts happening. And to try to push that away and avoid that because it was bad to feel angry or it was bad to feel sad, I think did more harm to my life than good.
Yeah, and many of us as women are raised, you know, to put that smile on our face and not to show our anger or frustration.
Right.
So we're going to take a very quick break. I'm talking with Betsy Chassie. Her book is called Tipping Sacred Cows. Jenny McCarthy of The View says that it's raw, open, honest, and hilarious. And I would agree, there are parts here that are really hilarious. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
OMG. Grammar abuses, no, LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Next week on Conversations Live, Jennifer Loudon, a pioneer of the self-care revolution and author of The Life Organizer, A Woman's Guide to a Mindful Year. And New York Times bestselling novelist Carla Neggers returns with her new story, Ciderbrook. Please join us every Monday at noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair, right here on Alternative Talk, 1150 a.m. and 98.9 HD Channel 3. See conversationslive.net for upcoming show details and podcasts.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you heal and stay healthy.
Tired of the insanity of other talk radio stations? Just click your radio knob and say, there's no place like Alternative Talk 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And I'm talking with Betsy Chassie. She's the author of Tipping Sacred Cows, The Uplifting Story of Spilt Milk, and finding your own spiritual path in a hectic world. She's also the co-creator of What the Bleep Do We Know? And, you know, as we evolve over the years, our ideas change. We formulate new beliefs, new philosophies. Betsy, you say that being spiritual isn't about what you practice, what yoga you do, whether or not you're a vegan. For you, you say, finding your meaning came when I looked at myself and asked, what do I want in my life and who do I want to be? And you let go about worrying about the hows of anything. So talk to us a little about spirituality and what that means to you, if you would.
Sure. Well, you know, I sort of felt like, I say this in my book, you know, it felt like there were these rules about what's spiritual, you know, and I say in my book that, you know, it's like there's this cow pasture in the sky and there's a panel running around saying, this is spiritual, this is not, put her down, you know, and it's like, it's like every single person has a different definition of what it means to be spiritual. And for me, I finally came to the conclusion, well, if we all have a different definition of what's spiritual, then everything is spiritual. And there is no separation between, well, he's living a spiritual life and he's not living a spiritual life. Life is spiritual. We are on the, like people often say, I started my journey eight years ago, and I often think, well, then are you eight? You know, I started my spiritual journey either before I got here or the moment I came out of the womb, you know? That was the spiritual journey. That's the beginning. Now, what you hope to do at some point is sort of say, wow, I really would like to do this and be present as opposed to running the program in my head. So maybe that's kind of what people mean when they say, I finally got on the path, is that they finally realize, like, oh, I have a choice here. I don't have to run this program. I don't have to run this, you know, this belief system that I've been carrying around. To me, you know, the big word around town these days is consciousness. Everybody wants to talk about consciousness. It's like quantum physics had its day, and everyone wants to talk about consciousness. And consciousness really just means, you know, after spending hours of interviewing scientists and new thought leaders, it just comes down to, are you aware of what you're doing? And
right.
So for me, that was the big change. It was just going, oh, I get it. I've been living a spiritual life because everything in life is spiritual. And now I just have to be aware so I can be more thoughtful in my choices.
Yeah. You say you spent a lot of time, you felt if you weren't manifesting what was on your vision board, for example, something was wrong with you. And that being spiritual to you became more about, at that time, doing it right rather than living authentically. And the change comes when you start to live authentically.
Right. Well, that's the thing, because we start to worry, like, am I doing this right? I mean, because you're not getting the vision board. You know, you put the Mercedes on the vision board, you focus on it, you meditate for 7 hours, and, you know, you do that for 6 months, and then you can't figure out why, you know, the Mercedes hasn't shown up. And what I started to realize was I need to start asking questions like, well, why do I want this Mercedes? What does this Mercedes represent to me? What does it mean to me? And really getting down and cleaning up and doing that work. And it's hard because we, you know, so often we're sort of bombarded with, you know, you have to find balance, you have to find peace, you have to meditate, you have to do it this way, you have to do it that way, that you start to feel like, oh, this isn't happening and there's something wrong with me. I must be bad. My ego's out of check. Whatever it is, we all have these great reasons. But I think really the real reason is, you know, you can call it your ego, you can blame everything else you want to. It really just comes down to I was just not asking the right questions. I was not living my authentic, true self. I was playing the role. And in doing so, was living a lie. And so when I could just get down to just being real, accepting who I was and figuring out who I wanted to be, you know, it doesn't matter what yoga I do. It doesn't matter what class I go to. It doesn't matter what book I read. All those things are great data collection, which I think is important. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I have to just use some discernment and do some work. I feel like I was just lazy and not really wanting to do the work. It was like I could grab that, you know, Deepak Chopra quote and just repeat that for a while and everything would be great. But then I didn't have to dig deep and get into the part of myself that I was hiding from.
Right. So it's superficial. And I think sometimes going back to what you said about, you know, we live our story. Sometimes we you know, get stuck. We just talked about habits and we're stuck in that habit of that same story. And sometimes we just need to take the time to stop and listen, as you've said, and rewrite that story.
And then also be okay with the fact that you were living with the story. People oftentimes go, oh, I can't believe I've been thinking this way. And we're really hard on ourselves, you know.
Okay, we've lost our guest. She's on a cell phone, so we're going to get her back, Eric. We'll take a quick break and we'll come right back.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Hi, I'm Pat Pauly. Tune into my show, Get Active, each Tuesday at 12 noon on Alternative Talk, 1150. Each week, we invite a guest to talk about one of the wonderful activities in the Puget Sound region, ones that you may want to participate in. We'll focus on how adult beginners can comfortably get into all of these activities. You'll learn a lot about how you can get active. Be sure to listen. That's Get Active with me, Pat Pauly, at 12 noon each Tuesday on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Hi, I'm Martha Childress with the Natural Choice Network. Join us every Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. right here on Alternative Talk 1150. Each week, we invite leaders from our sustainable community to share their unique visions and valuable insights. You'll learn great tools to make your life greener, healthier, and more sustainable for generations to come. Thank you for making the natural choice. That's the Natural Choice Network every Tuesday at 12:30 p.m. Please join us.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Body, mind, and spirit. Alternative Talk 1150 covers it all.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we have Betsy Chassie back on the phone with us. Betsy.
Sorry, I got all so excited. I moved my head around and I hung up on you. I was so excited.
Well,
about, like,
fine.
Shut up, girl.
Just,
you know,
fine.
I get passionate about thinking about all the little girls in the world who, you know, I was just on the phone with another friend of mine and she was telling me that her nickname when she was little was Tao. And like, I was just thinking about, God, like, these little innocent things, they end up becoming like crazy thought monsters in our heads as we get older. And it's mind-blowing when you think about it, you know?
Yeah. Well, you gave a good example in the book of when you lived in Yelm here in Washington and your daughter was called a rude name by a kid there. And your thought instantly is, oh my God, how long is that going to stay in her head, you know?
Yeah, and we do, I mean, as a mom, you know, for me, I've been doing a lot of work around feeling like I fail my children, because I've thought about, God, how many things have I ever said off the cuff, you know, just because, and not thinking about their impact and how they're going to land and how they're going to stick with us, you know, for a long time, and we don't even realize it.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the questions I usually ask people is, what do you wish you'd known 20 years ago, or 10 years, 30 years, depending on how long uh-huh. they've been around? And on your blog, you answered that question for us. So I want to just talk about that. And number one, there were three things. Number one, you say, seriously, it's funny. You may not think right. it now, but talk about that, if you would.
Well, I think that, you know, part of what we were talking about earlier about the spunkiness and the laughter is that I really come to the place of where you just got to lighten up and not take everything so seriously. And, you know, you're going to make mistakes. And the example that I give in that blog is like, you know, the story about when you're 20 and you wake up in your own vomit on your porch. And in that moment, you're horrified. And then you think you've ruined your life. And, you know, for me, thank God there was no Facebook in my 20s, because that probably would have done some laughing. I would have, like, had to deal with that. So my advice is laugh at these things and then figure out, well, okay, why, is this a regular thing that I'm waking up and vomit on my front porch? Or is that just a one-night random thing? And, you know, get clean about it and get clear about it. But don't let it define your entire life. I mean, don't carry around this guilt about something that you did when you were 20.
Right.
You know, live and lighten up and laugh. This, I mean, you're going to make really bad choices. There's not one person on this planet who has not made a really bad choice in their life.
Oh, absolutely.
The question is, what are you going to do afterwards, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Number two, you would tell your 20-something self, change is inevitable, so embrace it. Give yourself permission to change your mind. And we kind of touched on that a little. And then number three is, everything is going to be okay. Trust that.
Right. Well, you know, I think that when you're in your 20s, you see this whole life in front of you, and it can be really daunting, and you worry about every single choice. Now, I'm not suggesting that people, you know, not be conscious. I think people should be conscious and thoughtful. But just remember that things change, and you don't have to stay the same. You know, I had a really interesting conversation with a girlfriend who told me that she used to be a bully. She said, I used to be really mean. In high school, I was mean. I was horrible. I was snotty. I did things I can't even imagine that I did. And I had this moment. She actually said it was when she saw the bleep, when she realized, wow, I don't have to be this way. And she realized why she was that way.
Mm-hmm.
She had a lot of pain and a lot of hurt in her life. And, you know, she said, I can't go back and clean up every person that I might have hurt or everything that I did. She goes, I went to the people that I could and said, wow, I was a jerk. But I decided that I didn't have to be a jerk anymore. And she changed. And I've known her for several years. And she's an amazing person. You know, she's wonderful. So she changed. She realized, oh, I don't have to carry around the guilt of what I was when I was young.
Right.
I can take responsibility for that behavior. And I can move from it. I mean, there's always three steps. It's like acknowledging, responsibility, and moving forward. You know, you have to do those three things, you know. It's all you really can do, you know.
Yeah, and I think you're so right on having a sense of humor about life, because it can weigh you to your knees at sometimes, but if you can learn to laugh at least at yourself, you're halfway there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, this morning has been such a comedy of errors. I was on a shoot this weekend for Bleep, came home, kids coughing and hacking with the cold, and on top of that, they have headlights. And, you know, it's like, I've got a life to live this morning. I've got interviews. I've got stuff to do. In the middle of all this, I'm, you know, shampooing the hair, combing with the knit comb. I mean, the shower. I mean, it's all back. It's like ridiculous. And it's so like, I mean, I could really get stressed out and get worried and get emotional, which, you know, I did for about an hour last night. I kind of went into like, oh my God, I can't believe this is all that's happening. And then I woke up this morning and I was like, all right, if you deal with it from there, it's going to just get worse. You
right.
just have to think this is funny. You know, of course all this happened today. Why not? And just roll with it, you know?
Mm-hmm. And Betsy Chase, Chassie, I want to thank you so much for being with us. The book is called Tipping Sacred Cows, the uplifting story of spilt milk, and finding your own spiritual path in a hectic world. And you talking there about all kinds of things like blame, ego, anger, forgiveness, and truth. And I want to just thank you for being with us today. And listeners can find out more about Betsy and her work and upcoming work at BetsyChassie.net, BetsyChassie.net. Thanks for being with us, Betsy.
Thank you. Bye.
And I want to thank you, each of you, for being with us today. You can find out more about us at conversationslive.net. You can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. And we had a book giveaway on Facebook and Twitter last week. We had four copies of You Are a Badass to give away by Jen Sincero, who guested with us last year. And we have pulled the names of the winners from a random drawing, and that will be posted on Facebook later tonight. So check there. Of course, we'll be in touch with you if you are one of the winners. And thanks for being with us. Have to run. We'll be back next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.